The presenting sponsor of Top Docs is Netflix, now presenting the documentary series Escaping Twin Flames. From Emmy nominee Cecilia Peck, this three-part documentary series pulls back the veil on Twin Flames universe, a controversial online community that preys on people looking for love. Den of Geek says it tackles one of the more interesting subjects that streaming has in some time. Escaping Twin Flames is available now on Netflix.
Reality Winner is a feature documentary about NSA contractor Reality Winner, who disclosed one single document about Russian election interference and received the longest sentence a whistleblower, a media source, ever received in federal court.
Welcome to Top Docs. I'm Mike Merrill. You just heard from our guest today, Sonia Kennebec, about her documentary, Reality Winner. We were recommended to speak with Sonia by Wim Wenders, who was an executive producer on the documentary, which premiered at South by Southwest. Sonia has also directed other documentaries that you might say center around the American security state, such as Enemies of the State and National Bird, which focuses on U.S. drone warfare. As you'll hear, I was drawn to the film partly for its extremely important and still quite germane focus on the World War I era U.S. Espionage Act, which continues to play a role in the indictment of Donald Trump, for example, for keeping what the government likes to call national defense information in the bathroom of his Mar-a-Lago resort. Be prepared to have your view of the government's use of this legislation in this instance, as in every instance, to maybe be a little bit more complicated by the end of this interview. I also appreciate the way the film balances this political material, using the term in a broad sense, with the actual person who is Reality Winner. And yes, her unusual name is explained in the course of the film. And I was impressed by the choice that Sonia and her team made to marry her myriad timelines. I counted at least four or five major ones and others besides, without calling attention to the shifting timescape. I contrast this in the interview to the work of Errol Morris, who often very much does call attention to his competing timelines as an artistic and philosophical statement. It's interesting to see that despite their differences in craft, Morris has been an executive producer of Sonia's work as well. If you enjoy this conversation, please do follow us on Instagram or Twitter at TopDocsPod. Now, I speak with Sonia Kennebec about her film, Reality Winner. Sonia, welcome to Top Docs.
Thanks for having me.
Your film tells the story of Reality Winner, an Air Force veteran, a translator, who while working for a private contractor in the wake of the 2016 election, handed over a classified document to The Intercept, to a news media source, regarding interference by a Russian government-backed entity into the United States presidential election. I think there's a couple different frames of the story here, and it was really only when I was pulling it apart and analyzing it that I realized how many different timelines there are. And so obviously very well edited, you know, really holds together well. And you do so in a way which doesn't choose to call attention to its own complexity, and that's a choice. Compare this to like Errol Morris's recent The Pigeon Tunnel, which calls attention to the fact that it's messing around with timelines. Either way can work. So let me just break down these four timelines and then we'll jump in at various spots. I would say the dominant one tracks from basically when the FBI searches Reality's home and interviews her, subsequently arrests her, and you follow her family, her mother, Billy, stepfather, Gary, sister, Brittany, as they deal with her incarceration and advocate for her. And this is basically a year from the initial arrest to the outcome when she pleads guilty. But we have other frames as well. So we have the initial recording by the FBI in her home. You play this under some recreations of the scene, more on that later, and you revisit this throughout the film. And you also have an interview with Reality after she's released, about 4.5 years after the initial arrest, approximately. And finally, you have interviews with some other people who have been convicted for sharing classified documents, notably Edward Snowden, and with Betsy Reed and others from The Intercept, where you deal with the questions around The Intercept's handling of the information that Reality provided. So many different frames. I'm assuming that you started work on this documentary sometime after Reality's arrest and you focused on the family. Can you talk about just how you started this process and how you built the relationship with the Winner's Davis family?
So I read about Reality Winner's story shortly after she was arrested. And I think the reason my producing partner, Ines Hofmann-Kanna, and I paid attention to reality stories so early on was because we had made stories about whistleblowers. So we have a bit of a focus on whistleblower and national security stories. So when reality was first arrested, we knew what a big deal it was because there are very few national security whistleblowers, and there are even fewer people who worked within the NSA and take the risk and decide to disclose classified information. We just knew that it would become a much bigger case. But initially, there was this press release from the Department of Justice, and all it really said was that this young woman was arrested. And then we started reading everything that came out. And my producing partner encouraged me to fly down to Augusta, Georgia, where the pretrial hearings were taking place, just to see what was going on. We were actually working on another film at that time called Enemies of the State. And we thought we might include reality story as another one of the characters we would follow, one of the protagonists. When I was in Augusta, Georgia, one of the things that I first noticed was that there wasn't a lot of media coverage there. There weren't a lot of journalists. And that was very different than what I had expected. I thought because reality disclosed information about foreign Russian election interference, that there would be camera crews and journalists from national media, and that just people would be lining up to witness her case. That's not what was happening. It was, you know, very small group. I met Billie Winner Davis, reality's mom, and a few supporters, but really not many journalists from national or international publications. That was really the reason that we decided to start documenting her case, to bear witness, to really see what was going on, because we just felt that it would become bigger and that it was a really important case. What I didn't expect is that I would follow the story of reality's family rather than following reality herself, because I thought she would be released pretty quickly, like on bail, and that I would interview her throughout the process. That's not what happened. She was kept in pretrial detention for more than a year. So I really had to think about how to tell her story and how to represent her story while it was developing.
And we're going to talk a lot more about that. Despite that, you actually began the film with a close-up of reality. Really pretty tight close-up. She appears to be in the backyard of her parents' home in Southwest Texas. The shot captures both her, very close-up, she still appears quite young to my eye, and then this incredible expanse of land around here. And she begins with, "I am an airman, a veteran, and I was convicted under the Espionage Act." Can you just talk about starting there? Why did you want to start with that image and those statements?
So I started with reality's interview because by the time that she was released from prison, which was 4 years after her initial arrest, her story had really expanded and was pretty widely covered at that point. And that was not the case when we as a documentary crew started working on her story. We covered her story, and the film covers her story of about 5 years. When reality was first arrested, and I would say the first 1 to 2 years, there was so little media coverage. And we were actually kind of surprised, like, why is the media not covering this more widely? This is about press freedom. It's about whistleblower protection. It's about Russian election interference. And all these important themes that were widely discussed on the news networks. And somehow her case never really got, I think, initially the coverage that it deserved. And then along the way, a larger and in-depth magazine piece came out. Then there was a theater play based on Reality Winner's interrogation, "Is This a Room?" And then the theater play became a Broadway play. And now today we actually have 2 movies that were about Reality Winner. What we had, and I think we had this great responsibility as documentary filmmakers, was that we were covering the real story as it was unfolding from the beginning 5 years ago. And when I first was able, after all these years that I had already covered reality story, where I was following her family, where I was talking to her over a monitored jail phone line, where we had won a lawsuit. We actually sued the FBI to get the original recording of Reality Winner's interrogation, as well as her jail phone calls. And I've gone through her diaries, the diaries that Reality's family was giving to us. So we were able to get a sense who Reality is while we were documenting her case, because we had so little access to her. So I had all this image of who Reality is. And then, of course, the articles came out and the theater play, but no one could really speak to Reality until she was, like, openly, until she was out of prison. And so I did the very first interview with her, and everything was still very raw for her experience coming out of over 1 year in jail and then in prison, being under supervised release. We also filmed her actual release. We were there that day, so we really were very close to Reality's story. But when we sat down, Reality was telling me that everyone, so many people started talking about her story, and she became, you know, she was a joke on late night TV, and people were talking about her on social media, and everyone was talking about her name and how unusual it is. But the only person not allowed to speak was her. And she was actually the only one who could really tell her own story. And that's why I wanted to start that film this way, because by that time, 5 years later, Reality's story had become so much more wider covered. And I really wanted to hear from her and what she thought about everything that was going on, what people were saying about her, what the FBI, what the government was saying about her. And this film, Reality Winner, is really about Reality telling her own story from her perspective.
And in fact, she says that I've had 4 years of the narrative being controlled by the government and well-intentioned but misunderstanding journalists. But she really focuses a lot on the why. And I think this is really crucial to us, the viewer, not to the legal system. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But can you tell us why she released this information? Because I think some people might be surprised. I think the common narrative was she was a quote unquote liberal who was trying to hurt Trump.
And that was actually surprising to me as well, because everyone for all this time could only make assumptions, you know, including her own family. But the only person who could respond to the why question was her. And yes, I think a lot of people thought she did it because she was a liberal and really wanted to hurt Trump. But in fact, what she wanted to do is to settle the national debate. And that's what she says in the film, that what she saw in the media was the left and the right arguing about election interference. And people who had a political agenda were using this issue for their own purposes. So one side was saying there was interference, and that's why might have interfered with the actual vote. And then the other side was saying there was no interference at all, especially like Trump and his government at a time when she actually disclosed that information. They were saying nothing happened. There was absolutely, it's a ruse. There was no interference. And that was the conservative part. And then the more liberal side was talking a lot about the interference and kind of having this mistrust. And Reality saw that document. It came across her desk at the NSA, where she was an NSA contractor. And that document actually was evidence. And at that time, when Reality released it publicly, it was the first real evidence that showed that there was interference. The Russians tried to do a spear phishing campaign, and the FBI was investigating. From that document, you can really tell that there is an investigation, and it doesn't seem that they were successful with their spear phishing campaign, but it was something that the US government was clearly aware of. And what Reality thought, what she would do with this one document, is that really put out tangible information that was, you know, yes, there was interference, but also it didn't look like it actually impacted or influenced the election. But what it did was making people aware of a threat, that there was a real threat for the US elections. And that's why she disclosed it. What she says in the film is she wanted to settle the national debate and she wanted to unite the country. And that's the reason she disclosed the information.
She really believes Trump was elected. Like, she's not saying that that didn't occur. She's saying there was some interference and there will be some interference. And as you point out, the disclosure of this information actually helped get people to change some of the ways locally on the ground in various places they do things to protect against these sorts of things. As I said, one of the frames in the film is the interview by the FBI. As you said, you sued to get the actual transcripts, and you use them throughout the film in various spots.
Not just the transcript, but the actual recording. It's Reality's voice we hear. It's the actual recording that the FBI made during the interrogation, and that has never been released. So it's exclusive to this film.
You do some recreations, but you tend to show them either kind of like in reflections or there's some the lens is obscuring the image. Can you talk about your kind of theory of how to do the recreations and why you did them this way?
I do like to use recreations in my films, especially when you are telling a story that happened in the past and events that happened in the past that are really important to understand from a visual perspective. And in this case, because we had the original interrogation recording, and I knew from the beginning that I wanted to use it throughout the film because the interrogation itself has its own dramatic arc. You know, you can feel and hear the push and pull, how friendly the agents are at the beginning and how friendly Reality is, and then how she's backed more and more into a corner. And we actually had the opportunity to film in Reality's house and the exact room where the interrogation was taking place. So the images that you see in the film, the recreation, was filmed in one of the rooms in her houses, the interrogation room, and the way that she's backed up against the wall, she's opposite of these two much taller agents. It's all recreated very realistically because I had seen the agents in court. So I knew pretty much like how at least some of them looked like. And we also had the full information from the FBI that was submitted into the court and that was not redacted, where we could actually see how Reality was standing, how the agents were standing. And so I tried to recreate it really as accurately as possible. Because like she's really backed into a corner. You can see that in the film. But I also, at the same time, I wanted people to listen to the actual interrogation recording because you can hear so much in Reality's voice. It's one thing to read a transcript, but it's another thing to hear her fear, how she's getting quieter and quieter. So I didn't want the recreations to be distracting in any way. I wanted, you know, the audience to really be able to have a sense and they get sucked in and really listen to what was happening. So what we really worked with is, yeah, the reflections, witnessing their gestures of the agents, Reality, the way she was standing. We had one photograph of her and then we knew how it was taking place. And then as the film progresses, we were working a little bit with the camera speed, like the shutter speed, slowing down the time Everything in that interrogation is leading up to her discussing what she actually did, what was happening. So the FBI agents, with their tactics, are trying to hoax a confession out of her. And that's the drama in the interrogation. And then that moment when she actually confesses, and I don't think I'm giving away too much because she actually ended up in prison, but we all notice moments in our lives where something really dramatic happens and time slows down and everything narrows down to that one moment where you have the feeling you notice everything around you. And that's where we really try to use that in our recreation as well.
Yeah, I think you do a really good job of showing the ways in which, you know, the interrogators are using these tactics to dismiss the depth of what's going on here. Like, and in her mind, one of the crucial things is, and she talks about it, is her naivete, right? Also, in some ways, realism at the same time, which is, oh, I just gave one document, which wasn't about like where we're keeping our nuclear codes or anything. She said she didn't know she was going to prison. She knew about Chelsea Manning, about Snowden, about people who gave a lot of stuff over and who did deliberately and exposed a lot of important information. But she hadn't heard of somebody who committed a crime like hers. And we're going to talk more about the Espionage Act in a second, but you really are trying to paint her as somebody who didn't fully understand what she had done or what the government was going to say she had done.
Yeah, and I think she had, honestly, quite realistic expectations because when you look back at how the Espionage Act had been used against whistleblowers, it was first used widely under Obama against media sources, but these were people who really had a lot of documents, and Reality had one single document, The Intercept release, I think it was 5 pages. And so I actually, you know, I've been studying whistleblower cases, and I thought she would come out on bail. Yep. I thought I would interview her. I didn't think that they would come against her so harshly. But she was the first espionage case under Trump, and they really announced it that they wanted to make an example out of her. And they said it. They wanted to, you know, suppress information, and they wanted to go against whistleblowers so harshly to deter everyone else.
In the initial statement she makes at the beginning of the film, she talks about, I'm a veteran, and she says, I was prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And let's talk about that, because this was a choice, right? Prosecutors could have charged her with mishandling a sensitive document, a much less serious thing. Let's talk about the Espionage Act of 1917. It was created to stop saboteurs during the First World War. By the way, a time when the notion of free speech and press freedoms were much more constrained than we have arrived at our point in time in the United States. And the crime of the Espionage Act is to share national defense information, NDI, we can call it. By the way, anyone who's interested in this, there was actually a recent article in The New Yorker about this that's quite interesting. What is NDI? What is national defense information? Because I think people might think it's the most secret, serious stuff that we in the United States are protecting.
That is really the part where that a lot of people don't understand, including a lot of journalists and filmmakers like myself, where the Espionage Act, it was never written for this purpose of coming after media sources and whistleblowers. And it's, you know, three paragraphs, and it's really, it's very wide. And there has been a lot of criticism recently because you could potentially come after journalists as well, not just after journalist sources, but after journalists as well, because it has such a wide definition of what national defense information is. And you actually, or the government, it doesn't have to prove if it actually harmed the country. So just the fact that reality had disclosed something that was classified, and yes, it was classified, you can make this whole discussion about why information about threats to our election should be classified, because it also led to reforms and action, and government officials were saying, why is this classified? But that was interpreted, or that was used by the prosecutor to say it was a threat, and she disclosed it. And that's why the Espionage Act is so controversial. You can't go into it in your defense why you disclosed it and the good that it did. And that was really, that's called a public interest defense. And that was really causing a lot of problems for her, because it's really, did you do it or didn't you do it?
So the NDI itself is basically anything the government says it is. And also—
That's a much shorter way to put it, yes.
Yeah, it's going to be anything. And you say, this was classified, but everything gets classified in the government now. They stamp everything classified, say everything's classified. As you're starting to point out, also there is no consideration of motive. You don't have to intend to hurt your country. And also, you don't have to hand it to a foreign government. You don't have to hand it to someone who's trying to do harm. You can hand it to anybody. And you can intend anything, including what
she intended.
Or
just retain it as well. You can just retain it as well. Oh, I mean, Trump, you know, it's not really clear who he had passed it on to. There are some tapes that exist, but a lot of the information was just stored in his bathroom or so. I think this will actually really prove the case of the Espionage Act. And like, number one, if it's going to be applied fairly to everyone. But yes, it actually applies in Trump's case as well.
So the consideration of motive, what's interesting about this is kind of a double standard, right? Because she can't use her motivation in the courtroom to protect herself. However, the government can use, for example, random text messages she sent with her sister to show bad motive. She can't ever say she has a good motive, but they can say she has a bad motive. Is that right? It seems so unfair.
100%. And that's the huge problem. That's why so many journalists now, too, are criticizing the Espionage Act, because it is a risk to our free press. I'm an investigative filmmaker, and I work with sources. And I think some of the most important information for this country, and that's, you know, what we share in this film as well, it's like a little history of whistleblowing, like post-9/11, you know, government torture, the drone war, a lot of this information was mass surveillance, came out through whistleblowers and has been used to make, like, protect our rights more, that have led to, like, in reality's case, to make elections more secure. But all of that doesn't matter for reality, because she cannot use that argument to defend herself. And she cannot make a case or even say why she did what she did. And it also doesn't matter what good her disclosure did. But it really, at the end of the day, it comes down to, did she do it? Did she disclose classified information or did she not do it?
Let's talk about The Intercept. And I remember reading the article in New York Magazine back in 2017 by Jake Sorensen about The Intercept's, what they did here. And by the way, The Intercept had become famous for a place where you could take your sources. And you can see this in Laura Poitras's Citizen 4, where she shows Snowden and how they did that. It should be noted that Poitras eventually said she was fired from The Intercept for criticizing the way they handled reality's materials. You interview Betsy Reid and James Risen, who defend The Intercept to some extent. But just to start, can you explain the mistakes they made? I'm being generous here, folks, because another reading is they weren't mistakes. They just didn't care. But can you explain some of the mistakes they made in handling this material?
As investigative journalists, and I'm usually very careful about criticizing other investigative journalists because it is very challenging, as James Risen said, to go up against the U.S. government with all of its resources. And we are not the CIA, he says it in film, we are not the NSA. However, in this case of Reality Winner, mistakes were made that The Intercept later apologized for that led the FBI to Reality Winner 2 days before the article was even published. And that shows that, you know, not the article led to her, but it shows the mistakes that were being made during the investigation itself. And what happened was Reality Winner had mailed that document, a classified document, to The Intercept publication, which solicits classified material. They are asking, you know, they're saying on their website, whistleblowers welcome. They are asking for disclosures for leaks. They received a document and they weren't sure if it was real or not. And they actually took images and sent them back to the NSA to verify that document. And they very, very quickly, they sent it to their own sources. Their sources immediately cooperated with the FBI. And these printed out documents, they have printer marks. They are yellow, embedded during the printing process. And these printer marks allow the FBI to trace back the actual printer. So they have like a timestamp, a date stamp, and they could extremely quickly trace back that document to the actual printer that Reality Winner used. And what they should have done was they should have worked with their internal security team and they should have disguised these printer marks. And then also when I worked in investigative journalism, what we would usually do is that we would prepare, we would be very, very careful with information. And then of course you have to get at some point a government response, but you do it very close to publication because you do not want to give the government too much time to trace down the sources. And they actually did something else too. They gave them information from the postal stamp.
Right.
And that part, I honestly, I don't understand at all because they were disclosing from where the source was mailing the document.
You're kinder than I would be to them in this case. This is terribly sloppy at the minimum.
The risk is so high. That's the whole thing. I do strongly believe in investigative journalism. And as you say, I believe in whistleblowers. And sometimes we need real tangible evidence, documents. And that's what Reality was doing because there was this discussion, you know, online, everyone's talking about, did it happen? Did election interference happen? And in this case, when people do not believe what politicians say or the media and so on, like evidence can be so helpful. But we live in a time when sources are prosecuted so harshly. So I really think you have to do anything possible to protect your sources because they are most at risk. And journalists as well, but first the sources. But overall, I think as filmmakers, journalists, everyone who believes in a free press, we have to push against tools like the Espionage Act because I think they do limit the free press and free speech in this country.
I just want to talk about guns for a second. And
you're getting all the difficult kind of subjects in today. So,
this one really struck me because I think you call it out visually in other ways, but it helps that her AR-15 is pink. So they come in, they ask her what she has. She says she has an AR-15, a Glock, and a shotgun. And one of the agents says, just like my house, you know, sort of identification. And the other says, oh, is that the pink AR-15? Which I think signals that they already looked up what she had registered. They want to know going into the house, which totally makes sense. If I'm an officer, I want to know what the guns are in the house. But I'm betting, again, a lot of liberals like me, you know, city liberals would say, wait a minute, I thought reality was a liberal. Why she had such an arsenal? But this is just the water she swims in, right? I think it's hard for us to understand. Outside the big cities, this is the way people live in America.
Yeah. And I really don't think that reality can be boxed in. And that's why this documentary is important, because she, for the first time, can really tell her perspective. And it was not what, you know, other people were suspecting or interpreting. And the same as reality, she is like all of us. I think human beings are complicated, complex people. Yeah, and she really doesn't fit into a neat box. She's from rural Texas. She served 6 years in the military. She worked in a drone program. Yes, she is also an environmentalist, and she's a humanitarian, and she's interested in different religions, and she learns languages. She's a linguist. She speaks Pashto, Dari, and Farsi. She's a really interesting person, and she has a lot of layers to her. And part of it is that she is a gun owner and she likes shooting. And she actually has said, when we did our theatrical release and we did one screening that we brought to her to rural Texas, so she could actually travel to the screening because she's still under supervised release and she can't get outside of a certain radius and she has a curfew. So at, I think it was at one of this live Q&A where people from a community were asking her about if it's hard for her not to be able to be a gun owner anymore.
Right.
And she said,
right,
that's, yes, that's how I grew up. That's how my family was bonding. We went out and you see it in the film. They have a gun range at the back of the house. And that's what they do to relieve their stress, or they do as family bonding. It was very important for me to not come in and show just one aspect. But I really, you know, it's in the film that she was in a drone program. It's in the film that she's a gun owner. Her family likes to shoot it. But she also, the parts of her politics that are very liberal. And I think that's what makes a full and a whole person.
Also, it leads to this interesting tension in the interrogation, because they know exactly which guns she has, but they do not immediately secure those guns. And they're FBI agents. They're carrying guns as well. I think one of the questions people ask is, why did she confess? As you note, there was manipulation. There was the 4 hours. There was the difference in stature. There is the fact that she respects the agents. She's a veteran. She respects authority. She, okay, they're doing their job. She's got no problem with them doing their job. But she really feels like they belatedly secured her weapons. And she felt that created this incredibly tense thing where it's a four-hour interview. She goes to the bathroom. She's worried that they'll think she's reaching for a gun. A cat moves too suddenly. I mean, it really creates this tension in the scene, doesn't it?
Yeah, just like, as you said, a power imbalance. 11 male FBI agents come to the house of a single 25-year-old woman who lives by herself and takes her to the back room of her home, which she's called scary. She doesn't know to go into the back room of her home, and interrogate her for hours. And yeah, she had served in the military. She was really familiar with authority and following orders. And I think that plays in, her fear played in. She knew that they were armed. She was with her back against the wall. She was getting tired. She was afraid. She didn't know what was going on. She was really surprised because they came to her and raided her before the article was published with the document that she sent to The Intercept. So all of these things play in. And eventually, I think she just wanted to explain herself. You know, a lot of people, when you sit back at home on your sofa and you watch a film, you're like, oh, why did these people confess? I would have acted differently. But then I encourage people to think of moments where they were surprised by something, but they were caught completely off guard. You know, something happened that shook them, or, you know, someone said something to them in a moment where they never expected it. And do you always have the right answer at that point? And I think that's part, like, she was caught off guard, and a lot of people cooperate when the FBI comes to their doorstep. That's what happens. That's why when there are trainings, and I think this film is actually an important training tool as well for people who, you know, maybe who are journalists who want to protect their sources and don't want anything similar to happen to them, to really think about, like, how do you protect my sources and maybe call for an attorney right away? I think you have to practice it. It's really difficult.
Yeah, well, let's put this on the record here. If the police come and speak to you, don't talk to them, or the FBI. Do not speak to them.
Ask for an attorney.
Ask for an attorney. Do that first. Please, please, anybody, whether you're innocent or you feel you might be guilty of something, just do that. Okay. Let me ask you this. I think it's really interesting, and some people might be surprised, but then it dawned on them why. There seems to be limits to what reality can talk about. For example, she has to maintain her guilt. She can't plead her innocence. She's as a plea deal. She is on supervised release, on parole, you might say. She can't say, oh, I'm actually innocent. And some people who were convicted under the January 6th indictments are finding that out. They're going out and saying, oh, I actually shouldn't have been convicted, and they get called back into court. So as you were dealing with this, were you at all worried about exposing her further to further problems, her or any of the other people you have who are discussing the fact that they have shared classified documents? How do you find that balance so you can talk about it but not get them in trouble more?
Yes, I'm always very, very concerned about the risk that you have when you do films about whistleblowers. And there's always a risk, and you try to minimize it as much as possible, but it exists. And especially in this environment where I think there are more and more restrictions to our press and media freedom. So it is on my mind, and that's honestly what keeps me up at night. So I do think about, you know, it's always this balance, like how do we keep our sources secure while we do our job, which is documenting and reporting. And in this case, I knew, you know, this is a historic case, and what we are doing will be seen 10 years from now. So that was, you know, a difficult balance, and especially because we were filming while she was still in court. We were filming when she was pleading not guilty, and that increases the stakes because her mom had to be careful. Like, phone calls between reality and her family were used against her in court, jail phone calls. So we knew that she was being actively monitored the entire time. And you actually can hear some of these jail phone calls in our film because we got them as well through a lawsuit. But I spoke to her over a monitored jail phone line, and we actually did an interview. But I didn't really ask what I wanted to ask because I could have gotten her in trouble. And that itself, she wanted to have the conversation with me, but it was always like it was walking a line. So that was one of the things. I tried to get access to her. I requested interviews with her multiple times. And she knew about that because then in the prison, people were asking her about this. And that was also like, we didn't want her to get in trouble in prison, but we also, other people are giving interviews in prison. It is possible, but it happens in jail, it happens in prison, and it's a warden. So we wrote the warden when she was in prison, and then we wrote an open letter with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and then CNN signed on to it as well to get access to her, that kind of putting in public pressure, and that didn't work. There was always the worry that there would be backlash for her. So yes, I had to be careful during the production. When we did the interview, we were in touch with her attorney. I have a very good First Amendment attorney. I'm always in touch with a whistleblower attorney as well. So we had to follow that line to not get her into more trouble.
You have a couple different endings to the film. Let's talk about the coda, in my mind, which is the raid on Mar-a-Lago, where the Justice Department found a number of documents. We've spoke about them a little bit, that Trump had held, taken out of the White House. What's interesting about this, to my mind, is that many who probably would think that what happened to reality was unfair, she shouldn't have been charged with espionage, probably celebrated when they heard Trump was being indicted under the same law. What do you think the lesson of this is, actually?
I don't put my narration into the film because I always want to leave space for the audience.
Sure.
And it's very interesting for me to see their reaction. And it is what you say often, that people see reality's case and they think, oh my God, this is so unfair, especially what we know about Trump now. And then we have that little glimpse at the end, because it is a pretty ironic twist that happened, that Trump was raided under the exact same Espionage Act. Like, we could have never envisioned it. And I really thought this belongs in the film. Like, people have to see that double standard that has happened, because yep. Trump was raided and he was not immediately arrested, like reality. And he had boxes and boxes of material. I do think there's space for people to take away what they want to take away. For me as a journalist, I really think that people should be treated the same. That's essential to me. If you have this law on the books, you have to treat people the same. But I think Trump's case might show to us even more than previous whistleblower cases that the Espionage Act is a problem. It's a problem in this country. It's being already used against a publisher, Assange, against many journalist sources, whistleblowers, who by many people's accounts disclose information that was important and in the public interest. And I think it's stifling a free press. I think people, some of my peers are worried, and that's not what we want in a democracy. So I think the Espionage Act law has to go away because there are other laws. There are other laws in the books that right. You can use.
Yeah, or at least be amended so that it takes into consideration intent, purpose, who it's handed to, et cetera, et cetera. And again, the article that I mentioned earlier in The New Yorker may anger some people who are otherwise consider themselves, you know, against the Espionage Act, because it basically says the charging Trump under the Espionage Act is also a very bad idea that will lead to less freedoms. There's other things he could be charged under, but that one in particular. But I'll leave that to you. Your thinking. This opens questions, and that's what we want to do. So the other ending here, or near ending, is I think it's interesting because I think it balances out the start. So as we said, the first line is, I'm an airman, a veteran, and I was convicted under the Espionage Act. Sort of backward looking. This is where I was. And she ends with, I'm an athlete, yoga teacher, and sister. And it really is forward facing in the future. It really does seem that despite struggling with self-harming and suicidal ideation, that reality is coming into a world where she can think about herself in the future.
Yeah. And for me, really, this film on a second, on a meta level, is about who gets to tell the story and taking back her narrative. And that's what this framework for me is doing, that she is not only saying that, hey, everyone was talking about me except me, and now I'm telling my own story. But at the end, she says she's more than just that one act, that one action. But she is a full person. And she has so many other parts for personality and honestly her life. She really is reclaiming her life and her story in this interview and what she was telling to us. She's still very young. And I think she has a lot of ideas for her future, some activism. She's very interested in prison reform. She has been writing a memoir, and she is a very, very committed CrossFit trainer and an artist. Like, you actually see in her film, that's like sort of another layer that I tried to include her artwork. There are all these collages where I wanted to try to represent reality's personality when she was absent for a long time. And I did it through her diary entries in her artwork. But that's all her. And really, I didn't want to, you know, like some other headlines, reduce her to this one single act. But she is most certainly more than that.
Thank you for being here today. And thank you for bringing this film to us. And I think the film really finds a nice balance between showing a real person, a young person, in my opinion, of good intent, trying to make their way after some really tough years. But also, you know, by raising questions around the Espionage Act, surveillance state, we didn't talk about some of Snowden's insights into how we got here, press freedom, all these very important issues that are only growing in importance as we, you know, approach another election coming up very, very soon.
Thanks for having me and, you know, allowing me to discuss all these important issues. Mike, this was a really, I barely get to talk about like the layers of the film.
Right.
And
right.
When you were paying such good attention to the timeline, because as you said at the beginning, it's very subtle. My editor is Maxine Grudeke. She actually also edited Anselm, Wim Wenders' film. She is absolutely amazing. She's wonderful.
Do you have a hidden gem, a documentary film that you don't think gets the attention it deserves?
The film that I really loved this year and it really moved me was Q by Jude Shehab. I thought it was just an extraordinary documentary. The themes it discussed, faith and devotion and family and love and sacrifice, but also the filmmaking itself really moved me.
Top Docs is a production of Woolly Media. This episode was produced by Ken Jacobson and Mike Merrill and edited by Mike.